The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have Chuck Collins and Josh Hoxson to talk about the racial wealth gap. And we have the news crew, the people you've known for a while. So me, Brittany Clint, and Sam is back. Hey, Sam, welcome back. Before we get started, the message this week, it's about telling the people in our lives that matter to us, that they matter to us. That one of the things that I realized is that there are a lot of people who go through life who care so much about other people, who love deeply so many people in their lives, who just never say it, who never show it, who just assume that the other person knows it. And that's just like a not good way to go through life with those assumptions. So my push to you, is there anybody in your life who doesn't know that you love them, or who might question whether you love them, but you do? It's like, we got to tell those people that they matter to us. We got to remind them about the joy that they bring in the world and the light that they bring in the world, and just how important they are, and don't take those things for granted. Well, that's it. Let's go. And here's the news with me, Brittany Pecknett, former member of the Ferguson Commission and appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing and a current education professional. Samuel Siangwe, our resident data scientist, and Clint Smith III, our resident academic.
Hey, y'all, it's the news. This is Brittany Pecknett at Ms. Pecchetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Siangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter and Instagram.
Instagram Sam.
Yes, Instagram.
This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III on Twitter and Instagram.
And this is DeRay at DeRay, D-E-R-A-Y on Twitter.
Welcome back, Sam. We missed you.
Yes.
I didn't do the I that time. You're welcome.
Yeah, so I'm technically not back yet. It's my last day in Hong Kong, so I'm staring out on the incredible Hong Kong skyline, and it's a great place. If anybody wants a place to vacation, I definitely recommend Hong Kong, and I'll be back tomorrow.
What have you been doing in Hong Kong, Sam?
This was your birthday trip?
Yeah, so it's birthday, so I turned 28 yesterday, and...
Oh, you made me feel so old. Oh, my gosh.
And it's also our 10-year anniversary.
10 years,
a decade.
That is a long relationship. That's longer than I've done anything in my entire life besides school.
That was so shady. Oh my god!
Why is that shady? That's true. Yeah, are you moving to Hong Kong, Sam? Sam, you've been bragging on Twitter about how great Hong Kong is. The infrastructure is so great.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's been incredible to see. Like, I mean, the infrastructure is one piece of it, but the whole city is just like futuristic.
Is it more futuristic than Wakanda?
Oh no.
Ooh.
Oh no. They don't have the flying cars here. So that's like, once they invent that, then they might have a claim.
See, I was trying to get Sam caught.
Hey, Clint, you have also been around the world in like 2 days. Did you miss Baby J?
I did. Baby J, man, what a kid. He's almost a year old now. He is so pleasant. And he started walking. He's like moving. He is taking multiple steps. He's like, then he gets too hyped and he starts to run. And that's when he, you know, busts his butt. But he's great. He's got his little...
These are life lessons, though.
Got a little baby fro, and he's just out here. He's just out here living. Carefree black boy George.
Is this a teeth fade? They're teeth
now,
right?
There are two teeth on the bottom, and then he has one big old front tooth coming through. And so he's got this kind of, it's endearing because he's a baby, but like, you know, he's just got this one, just like this one big old tooth popping out of his mouth. And I'm just like, it's cute because you're 11 months old, but you know, we have to work this out.
So one of my favorite streaming shows, Dear White People, recently returned to Netflix for its second season. Pew, pew, pew. Shout out to Dear White People. That is not an ad. I absolutely love that show. I was super anxious for the second season to come back, and there's a cliffhanger in the season finale, and I'm just like, I'm so ready for the third season already. I will not give you any spoilers. I will give one thing away because the most compelling part of the new season for me was actually watching a young Black college student decide if she would terminate her pregnancy. Now, I promise no spoilers, so I will not tell you what her decision ends up being. But the show's decision to cover this is actually really groundbreaking, meaningful, and in my opinion, really worth discussion. So here's why it mattered. According to research by Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, with very few exceptions, most TV depictions of abortions center young white women in committed relationships who are not parenting another child or other children already. A majority of these women were depicted as middle class or wealthy. Most of them were in their 30s, and teenagers were disproportionately represented in those plot lines, according to this research. That's the depiction on television. Here's the reality. In 2014, a majority, 60% of abortion patients were in their 20s. No racial group made up the majority, but people of color obtained the procedure at disproportionate rates. 3/4 of patients were low income, and a majority, 59%, had already had at least one previous birth. Now, here's why this matters. This is often how conversations of importance begin in pop culture. They begin by examining how it affects the most privileged almost exclusively. It took years, for example, for R. Kelly to come tumbling down, even though a white male reporter and many Black women, myself included, have been pushing consumers and companies alike to stop purchasing and promoting his music. This week, Spotify and then Apple Music finally decided to stop promoting him, but this was after months of centering the stories of the sexual abuse and harassment in entertainment that white women suffered, and not the young Black women that R. Kelly has allegedly targeted. These imbalances are not only felt emotionally by the most marginalized among us, but they're also felt in the outcomes. We can see the difference in what actually happens in response to these crises. When we talk about representation in pop culture and societal conversations, it's not just about inclusion for inclusion's sake. When the pop culture landscape changes, policy changes. We've seen this be true of Time's Up and LGBTQ issues, and lack of access to reproductive health care continues to disproportionately affect women of color and women living in low-income circumstances. So I'll end with this. A woman named Dr. Jennifer Conti, who is a fellow at the Physicians for Reproductive Health, said this: "We continually fail these women in healthcare access, including contraception and abortion care, so it's no wonder that we see these differences. Painting a different picture in the media obscures this reality further and invites ignorant policy changes that do nothing to protect vulnerable women." And you all, that is exactly the point. The personal and pop culture is always, always political.
So I think, you know, Brittany, one, I haven't seen the new season yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Dear White People season one was incredible. The movie was incredible. Actually, is the movie connected to the series? Like, is it the same? Like,
yeah, so it's not all the same actors, but it's the same, like the same guy, Justin Simien, who created the movie, created the series.
Cool. Yeah, so series one was incredible. I think, you know, to your point, the narrative matters, right? The public narrative of who is sort of the popular conception of the person that we're talking about when we talk about social issues, ranging from, you know, abortion to a whole host of social issues that we talk about often animates our policy, you know, response. I think about this issue of, you know, who's on welfare being another one of those examples where for so long, the depiction of who is on welfare was this idea under the Reagan administration of the welfare queen. And you know, that was used intentionally to create an environment where people were less likely to support that program and led to some cuts. And I think about what are the political implications of a narrative around abortion that does not center the people who are most likely to depend upon that service or utilize that service for their reproductive health. And I think, you know, I would be interested in seeing across the range of different issues that are sort of the most pressing issues in our society. How does the public narrative differ from the actual people who are disproportionately utilizing those services? And how does that impact policy? Because I think it is something that, you know, as you said, has huge implications in people's lives and in the policies and systems and structures that shape them.
There are a couple of things that I think of that I hadn't thought of before. So, Brittany, thanks for bringing this. You know, as much as we talk about the media representations of the police and mass incarceration, I just hadn't like really thought about other representations, including representations of abortion. So, like that study that you talk about that shows that the people who have abortions on TV are disproportionately whiter, younger, and wealthier than their real life counterparts. Like, that's fascinating because it does sort of change the way people think about policy. It changes the way that people think about the issue writ large. What I also found out is that on screen, only 15% of characters getting an abortion already have children, when in reality, 61% of women who get an abortion are already parenting. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting is that on TV, the most common reasons a TV character gets an abortion is this idea that it interferes with future opportunities. So on TV, it's depicted as like, you know, a woman wants to advance in her career, insert abortion, like get an abortion, stuff like that. Whereas what is happening in real life, the data is suggesting that 40%, that the single biggest driver is actually people not being financially prepared. And like, this made me think of just how much public policy and public discourse is actually shaped from the aggregate of media representations of issues. And yeah, I'm still thinking about it, but I thought that was really interesting. And Sam, what you talked about with like welfare, who's on welfare, we think about like who are victims of police violence, like all these things are really shaped and influenced by media representations. And, you know, Teen Mom, they talk about Teen Mom as having one of the biggest impacts on teen pregnancy. And like, you think about just like how mass media shifts the way we think about things that are sort of like you take for granted how complicated they are.
I'm really glad all this has been brought up. And it reminds me, especially the relationship between abortions and socioeconomic status, which I think is a really important thing to be thinking about. And it reminded me of this study from the American Journal of Public Health that talked about how carrying an unwanted pregnancy to term quadrupled the odds that a new mother and her child would live below the federal poverty line. And I thought that this was pretty staggering in showing the relationship between poverty and denying a woman her reproductive rights and the right to make her own decisions. And the single most common reason women cite for wanting an abortion is because they cannot afford to raise a child, according to this report. And when so often women are saying very explicitly to lawmakers, this is a decision I am making because I am cognizant of what I am able to offer or not offer this child. And I think this study is just an important reminder for us to be cognizant of the relationship between poverty and reproductive health.
I just want to remind folks that being pro-choice doesn't mean that the choice itself is easy, or that women who choose to terminate a pregnancy do so cavalierly or with cowardice. Mother's Day really had me thinking about this and had me thinking about how so many women experience life differently. And for women who have had abortions, it's just really disrespectful to speak of them as though they are callous or cold, uncaring or incapable. Just because we women have the right to make the choice doesn't make the choice easy. And the lack of access to make that choice still plagues far too many of us.
So my piece of news is about marijuana arrests in New York City. An article came out in the New York Times called "Surest Way to Face Marijuana Charges in New York, Be Black or Hispanic." And you know, this is a fascinating analysis. They looked at 911 and 311 calls data throughout New York City to help understand sort of why police were disproportionately likely to arrest Black and brown New York City residents for marijuana charges, despite what we know to be true about Black, brown, and white communities using marijuana and dealing marijuana at similar rates all across the country. And you know what they find, just for some context, there are about 17,000 marijuana arrests each year in New York City. That is under the current mayor, Bill de Blasio, who promised to end those marijuana arrests. They have reduced from about 50,000, but they have not ended. 87% of people arrested for marijuana in New York City are Black or Hispanic. And, you know, what is most interesting about the analysis that they do here is that they directly sort of debunk and unpack the police justifications for this and police explanations for these disparities. So the police, you know, the police have a script. So if you've been following issues of police violence, particularly against Black and brown communities, you already know this script. Most people know this script and have heard it before. And that script is that police are more likely to arrest or use force against or even shoot or kill Black and brown residents because they are simply responding to dangerous situations and high levels of violent crime in those communities and therefore are merely enforcing the law and responding to the complaints of residents there. And that's sort of the script that you hear again and again and again. You won't see an article about racial disparities in policing without hearing some police official or criminologist who used to be a police official use that as their sort of attempted justification for these disparities. And what the New York Times does is actually look at the data on 311 and 911 calls to police for marijuana possession. And what they find is that even in areas that have similar rates of calls about marijuana, Black and brown neighborhoods are much more likely to have police arresting people for marijuana. So police are not merely responding to the call and arresting people at similar rates, regardless of who calls or where they call. They are specifically more likely to arrest Black and Hispanic residents in Black and Hispanic areas in New York City when police are called. This just sort of adds to a growing body of research that shows that, you know, even when you control for the levels of crime in an area, even when you control for the likelihood that people are to call police for a particular situation, police are still more likely to arrest Black and brown people and are more likely, we learned from the Center for Policing Equity research, are more likely to use force against Black and brown people during those arrests. I'll sort of leave that there, but I think this is a really powerful way of using data to systematically unpack and debunk the police narrative around so many of these issues, not just for marijuana, but around their justifications for disproportionate policing in Black and brown areas altogether.
I think it's also really important to put this analysis in conversation with the way that we think about recidivism. And so I'm constantly reminded in conversations with folks that people sort of misunderstand what recidivism is and how it operates. And so for those who don't know, recidivism is when someone goes back to prison or jail after they have been released. And that is traditionally one of the metrics that are used most often to measure the sort of efficacy of, you know, programs that are meant to keep people out of prison after they've been released back into society. And I think that sometimes when people see that someone recidivated or that they reoffended, they automatically assume kind of implicitly that they committed a similar crime or a crime that's analogous to what they had done before, right? So if somebody committed a violent crime in the sort of collective imagination of many Americans, because we haven't been taught or we don't necessarily have the language to think differently about it, we often think that they are doing something that is similar to what they did before. But instead, oftentimes people are violating parole or even probation for reasons for you know, again, quote unquote, crimes that are much of a much lower level and lower tier than what they initially were incarcerated for. Right. So that you may have been released on parole and you have, you know, a dime bag of marijuana on you. And then you end up back in prison and for a much longer sentence because you have violated your parole and it doesn't matter what the nature of the crime was. It's that you violated one of the conditions of your parole. And so I bring that up just because I think sometimes when we see these recidivism numbers, people can say like, oh man, these people go back into society and they engage in the exact same activities and problems that they were engaged in before. But oftentimes the things that end up putting people back in prison have to do with mental illness. They have to do with the sort of drug use or abuse that that again, many people do all the time and don't find themselves incarcerated for. So I just wanted to bring that to the conversation because I'm continuously reminded that that folks don't always necessarily understand that that's how recidivism works.
Yeah, I think it's just a reminder that people are uncomfortable naming racism as racism. That Sam, like Sam talked about, you know, people did backflips to try and explain away the disparity in marijuana arrests. So like they did the whole, well, there's more crime there, the neighborhoods are more dangerous, and the data will show. And like, that just wasn't true. What we knew to be true the whole time was that it was just straight up racism, and people are like nervous about that, or people are not even nervous. They just like won't admit the truth. What's interesting about weed is that we arrest more people for weed than all violent crimes combined, which is like a fascinating thing to just like sit with. And that we know that blacks and whites use pot at about the same rate. White people, when you look at the data, there's a study that just came out from, or that came out recently from the ACLU, is that white people actually use weed more than black people. But again, but blacks have been nearly four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than white people. And in Iowa, D.C., Minnesota, and Illinois, black people are 7.5 to 8.5 times more likely than whites to be arrested. This is not a matter of, like, who is doing what. It's a matter of, like, who is being policed for doing what. And that these are all choices. Like, we can make a different choice. Over 50% of Americans support the legalization of marijuana. So there seems to be something deeper at the root that just like wants to penalize people for engaging in this behavior that we know actually doesn't lead to, like, it's unclear there are medical downsides. Like, it doesn't lead to the impaired judgment that, like, you know, alcohol does. So I'm hopeful that this study will help open up space for legalization to take off.
And so I just wanted to talk about how there's an exciting new book that's come out, and it's actually not very new at all. It's a book that was written by Zora Neale Hurston, who if you have not, for some reason beyond anything I'm able to understand, if for some reason you have not read Their Eyes Were Watching God, you should pause the podcast and immediately go read that novel, because it is one of the most central literary text of our canon, I think, of the sort of international canon of literature. And was so groundbreaking and so important for many reasons. But what's interesting about this project is that Zora Neale Hurston was a novelist, but she was also an anthropologist. And about 60 years after the abolition of slavery, she made this incredible discovery, and she found the last surviving person to have been brought on a slave ship to the United States from Africa. This is a project and a book that she had been working on, but that in the 30s she couldn't find any support for. But it is being published, or it's just been published rather, and it's called Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo. And in the book, she talks about Cujo Lewis, who was born in what is now the West African country of Benin. He was originally named Kasula and was 19 years old when he was brought, captured and brought to the United States. And he and about 120 other people were sold into slavery and transferred on ships across the Atlantic. And what's interesting is that even though slavery was legal at this time in the United States, the international slave trade was not. And so this was, you know, and it hadn't been for about 50 years, but this shows that slave traders were still engaging in the practice of transporting slaves across the Atlantic for decades after it had been outlawed and abolished. And just generally, I think this is a really interesting and important text. One, because Zora Neale Hurston, true to form, tries to capture Cujo's voice and his essence in the sort of dialect that he used, which is something that, if you're familiar with the sort of black literary history, is something that she was actually very much castigated for by Richard Wright and by others, because they thought that when she did that for Their Eyes Were Watching God, that she was somehow making black people look bad by trying to capture the true essence of their speech and the nature of their dialogue as compared to their white counterparts. And Zora fundamentally rejected this. She talked about how there was something really special and important about capturing the true nature of the way that black people spoke, and that there was a sort of magic and a music in that that was really essential. And obviously we look back on that now in a way that recognizes that she was right. I think many people consider that to be the case, but this is another thing that she uses in this book. And it's also just a really important thing to hear the voice of someone who was actually brought to this country on a slave ship. And I haven't had the pleasure of reading the book yet, but I'm really excited to dig in.
I'm so glad that you brought this up. I have been obsessed with Cujo Lewis. I visited his gravesite a couple of weeks ago when I was down in Saraland, Alabama, which is in Mobile County. So it's very close to this burial ground where Cujo Lewis and both the other people who came over on the Clotilda, that slave ship, and many of their descendants are buried in a place called Africatown. And Africatown was established in 1866 after emancipation, when many of the people who either came over on that ship or who were descended of them, when they couldn't return back to Africa, they came and created Africatown in Mobile. The modern day fight that Africatown has been continuing to take on is a study in the convergence of environmental racism, industrialization, and what is often called planned obsolescence, which is essentially people intentionally working to make places like Africatown, that was founded by former slaves, that was governed by former slaves, that was run according to their traditions and values and beliefs, the work to try to make that place obsolete. So everything from a highway and a bridge that helped make the community obsolete, such that many businesses cannot survive there anymore. And so people have to put their tax dollars into the surrounding towns, places actually like Saraland, Alabama, where, of course, our sister Shakisha Clemens was assaulted by a police officer in a Waffle House a few weeks ago. But what also happened was that a company called International Paper built a factory very close to that space, and the pollution ran off into that space, into Africatown. And so researchers concluded that people born after 1945 just seemed to be dying before the age of 65 because the ash that spewed from the paper mill was never properly cleaned up and made the residents sick. Unfortunately, this kind of environmental racism is experienced all over the country, but especially in this place that is where Cujo Lewis docked, that is where these formerly enslaved Africans, now Americans, decided to build their own land and to build their own community. The fact that it was happening there in particular is a real travesty. I've been posting about Africatown and talking about Africatown every chance that I get. And I think that this book will help not only bring Cujo Lewis's story to the forefront, but also hopefully help people invest in the fight that current residents of Africatown, many of them descendants from the people who came over on the Clotilda, are taking on every single day. Also, if you are in Mobile, there is a restaurant, Black-owned, called Kazula, one of the few Black-owned places in downtown Mobile that I go to every time now that I've gone down there a couple of times. These kinds of things cast a long shadow. And the shadow right now is that Africatown is still fighting for itself, is still fighting for its life, is still fighting for its existence. So Cujo Lewis is an important part of history, and I'm hoping that as you learn more about him, that we will each do what we can to support that fight that Africatown is continuing to take on.
The public narrative needs to catch up with the historical reality, which is that these types of things that we talk about did not actually end, you know, magically in 1 year. They began to be phased out, and we need to start asking questions about, you know, to what extent have they been fully phased out, or if they have not, what remnants of those issues continue to this day that we need to abolish.
Now, I'll just add that this reminds me of the importance of first-person narratives. And like, what happens when there's a whole set of people who aren't allowed to read and write, who aren't taught to read and write, that like history just forgets their stories? So you get all these sort of retellings of slavery and that entire period that are from observers and from sort of well-meaning abolitionists and from religious texts. And that you actually just don't have like a huge cadre of first person narratives about like what people experienced. And that's such a loss for anybody trying to uncover the truth. And it's a reminder of like the seemingly basic things like literacy and education that like they have an importance in terms of how people interact with the world today, but they have a huge importance about how we remember this time in the future. And that's one of the things that this, like everything everybody else said, I co-sign. It makes sense. It's great. It's right. And I'm just like reminded of like what happens both here and across the world, where like you think about the genocide that's happening in countries, or like the human rights violations, and like in what happens when people don't have access to like write about it and tell that story. That's one of the ways that oppression works, by always being able to manage the narrative. So you get a story like this to break through. And it's a reminder of what Sam said about the recency of this. It's a reminder what Brittany said about how this is functioning in real time, and what Clint said about how these stories sort of work as levers of power. Okay, my news is about phone calls and phone call tracking. So Securus is one of the largest prison phone call companies in the country. But I'm not going to talk about that today because we had a whole episode on prison phone calls. But what is interesting is that Securus actually offers another feature that has nothing to do with prisons per se, that allows law enforcement and correction officers to pinpoint almost exact locations of any cell phone in the country. So there's this one scenario where a woman, she was sentenced to drug rehab. She left the center, but she was eventually located using this service. And there was another example where a missing Alzheimer's patient was found. And then there was another case where a detective was looking for a murder suspect, and they got within 42 feet of this person's, this suspect's location. The question is, like, how did we get here? So what I didn't know is that the phone companies sell the ability to acquire location data to all types of companies, mostly for marketing purposes, like providing coupons when someone's near business, or services like roadside assistance or bank protection. But the agreements that those companies sign are like not, they're like paper thin. So Securus like played the game well, and they offer this service to law enforcement where they can literally just track people's cell phones without a warrant, without following any sort of legal restrictions. And another thing I didn't think about with this is that Lee Petro, who's one of the lawyers that we had on early to talk about prison phone calls, is that what he was saying about this is that they're worried that the prisons are actually going to start to try and locate the people that inmates talk to on the phone, because like they'll know their phone numbers. And like, that's just a frightening world where, like, unchecked by any sort of legal precedent, no law, that some private company can literally find to like the foot, like where you are in the world, real time at any place, is wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild, and it's especially wild when you think of it in combination with all of the other sort of police technologies that are beginning to be used. And so one of those is predictive policing. So we talked about how crime data, you know, often is biased because it just reflects the police understanding of crime or crimes that are reported. It often disproportionately involves Black and brown people, you know, beyond with the scope of actual crimes committed. And I think when you think about the fact that now not only are there predictive policing algorithms that can deploy police officers to particular locations based on this flawed data, but now they can also track people's cell phones to find people in these locations, find them, you know, apprehend them based on an entire sort of data collection apparatus that doesn't have much public input. So when police departments adopt these new technologies, or as you said, DeRay, begin to get access from these companies to cell phone location data, there's not like a referendum held. You know, the city council usually doesn't vote on it. The mayor doesn't vote on it. It's just something that happens behind the scenes in terms of their contracts. And yet this has so much to do with how people, in particularly in Black and brown communities, experience policing now, and how that policing is being expanded and becoming even more intrusive. So we have to have a conversation about what types of rules and regulations and protections and privacy protections should people have from this type of stuff. I know that there are a couple of bills that have been introduced in city councils. There's one in California. There's another that has been introduced, I believe, in New Jersey to like require some level of public input before these types of technologies are adopted. But it is a huge sort of new frontier in over-policing and police violence that needs to be addressed, that is often unspoken about.
Frankly, the whole thing is scary to me, especially when I read in the article that you sent, DeRay, that the police do this by going through a system typically used by marketers and other companies to get location data from major cell phone carriers, including AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon, which is basically all of the major cell phone carriers. And I'm reading that and I'm like, how did they get that information in the first place? Oh, I'm very sure it's by those terms and conditions that we don't read, but we just sign. Why? Because the companies know that we need their products. Like they don't actually have the onus to change how they're operating and the kind of information that they access and the kind of information and the ways in which they use that information, because they know we're going to sign that darn document. Even if we read the entire thing, we're still going to sign it because we still need that cell phone. We still need to be able to be in touch with our friends and family. We still need the internet access, et cetera. And so, the whole thing up and down from the company level to the police level really bothers me and makes me deeply worried about the direction that we're moving in regards to our privacy, because we have less and less and less of it every single day. And every single day we find out just how much of it we signed away without even knowing it.
That's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
Here we go with Chuck Collins and Josh Hoxson on the Racial Wealth Gap. Chuck and Josh, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod to Save the People.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I first came across your work because I was obsessed with the study The Road to Zero. And, you know, as much as I thought I knew about the wealth gap, I think that I actually knew about the wage gap. And I would say that that is true of many people, that 5 for 15 was about income and about wages. And that became a national conversation. I didn't realize that I didn't really understand the wealth gap. So I'll start with, you know, how do you think about the difference between income and wealth? And like, how have you helped people just see that difference in a way that made sense to them?
Well, I think that one of the things we try to point out is income is important. It tells the story of kind of what's happening in the present, what's happening in terms of people's income and flow, the flow of money into their lives and the flow out. But when we often overlook wealth, defined as what you own minus what you owe, and how important wealth is to people's sense of security and well-being and savings and financial investments. And what Josh and I have been trying to point out a lot is wealth is where the past shows up in the present. It's where you sort of see the multi-generational forces on someone's life. So you may see a research study that says, look, the income gap or the racial income gap is narrowing, but the racial wealth gap is widening. And to us, that is a more meaningful indicator of just kind of people's well-being and security.
How does that happen, though? What most people would say is that, like, if the income gap is closing, then the wealth gap should also be closing. How does it work that they are operating in two different directions?
What's happening is that as people generate income, you know, it's assumed that they're generating wealth at a similar rate, and they're not. And the reasons for that are multitude. First of all, black houses don't appreciate at the same rate that white houses do. Second of all, the return on investment for people investing in their own lives, which is to say putting money into education, you know, reducing their student debt, things of that nature, that doesn't generate the same return to a black family that it does to a white family. And folks like Tom Shapiro at Brandeis University have studied this in depth, showing that if you compare black and white families over a long period of time, having more income does not mean more wealth. And a lot of that comes back to what Chuck said previously, which is that basically intergenerational transfers of wealth show up in a lot of different ways, and they're not often talked about. And I experience this all the time, where people are really hiding how much intergenerational privilege they have, and that privilege in this country is most often skewed along racial lines.
That's interesting. When you say they're hiding it, what does that look like? Like, what does that mean?
Right. So this is the most common way I hear this is folks, you know, usually when people transfer wealth, it happens in a few different times. It happens when they graduate high school or when they graduate college or when they go to get married or when they have a kid, like major life events. And what I see is stories that replicate themselves. And I first heard about it from Professor Shapiro at Brandeis, and I've since watched it play out over and over and over again. Here's how it goes. And I suspect you and a lot of people listening have heard the same story. You know, people say, oh, you know, I bought a house, you know, where we had to save up. we were, you know, pinching our pennies. We were driving for Uber. We were working extra shifts. We were had a yard sale, so on and so forth. And, you know, by the way, my parents gave us $30,000. And it's like, wait a second, how did you do that again? And, you know, what it does is it reinforces this narrative that if you work hard, you can get ahead and you can afford things. And the reality is, you know, I live in the city of Boston, which is one of the most expensive cities in the country and really in the world. And what I'm witnessing is it's near impossible for anyone working anywhere near the median income to save up for the runaway housing costs in this city. So it's completely disingenuous to say, like, oh, I got there on my own. It's not to say you didn't work hard. It's to say that intergenerational transfers of wealth or inherited advantage helped along the way. And I think the first step to solving the racial wealth divide is acknowledging that fact, people acknowledging that, you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with me as a person. I just got some help. And if I don't acknowledge that help, it's hurting other people. It's actually actively hurting somebody else who's looking in the mirror and wondering why they can't do what I did when what I did required something that I was born with.
Now, the Road to Zero is what first sort of put me on to the work that you were doing, specifically both of you, around the racial wealth gap. I don't want to give away the top line of the Road to Zero, so I will ask you to tell us what the conclusions of the study were.
Right. So what we did in the study was we looked back at the last 30 years of trends in household wealth. So from 1983 to 2013 was the most straightforward data set from the Federal Reserve. And what we did was project that same trend line into the future. So what if we did nothing in exactly the last 30 years projected into the next 30 years? And what we found was that Black and Latino wealth is trending downward and white wealth is trending upward. So the main line, you know, by 2053, so in a few short decades, Black wealth will hit zero. 2 decades later, Latino wealth will hit zero. And in that time, we're going to become a majority-minority country, which is to say that white people will no longer make up over 50% of the population. Among the youth, that's already happening, and as a full population, we'll see it. So that's the unaddressed, just let things go on as they've been going.
Like, I was trying to understand the difference between Hispanic wealth and Black wealth. Like, how do you account for the differences in the rate at which it is changing?
I mean, distinctions between, you know, Latino and Black families is a little bit complex. What it basically comes down to is partially this question of long-term impact of things like slavery, things like when folks migrated to this country, how communities have been able to generate wealth, you know, through entrepreneurship. Latinos have a much higher rate of entrepreneurship than any other demographic. So there's some sort of micro stories within, you know, the Black-white gap. And then, you know, there's the much more amalgamous question of, like, do Black families experience race-based discrimination at a higher level? You know, the long-term impact of redlining, which we can talk about. And I don't have the academic answer to that question. I can just point out that the experience of oppressed people across demographics is dramatically different for different populations. So it's not to say that, you know, all people of color have experienced the same type of oppression in the United States. It's just to say that, you know, there are obvious and distinct differences between these groups.
I have one thought, which is I think the legacy of racism in relation to housing and home ownership has sort of played out historically differently. So, you know, after World War II, you really did have, this sort of deep systemic discrimination in mortgage lending. It also affected Latino households, particularly like in the, you know, the Chicano populations in the Southwest. But white families got on the wealth building express train, and families of color, primarily systemically African-American families, were barred from access to mortgages, which actually pushed people into kind of the predatory, you know, people wanted to own a home and they ended up getting these, you know, contract for deed mortgages, which, you know, you miss a payment, you lose all your equity. So they were kind of almost like wealth extracting, wealth stripping lending arrangements. So that's where you saw this dynamic of accelerating advantage for white families and sort of compounding disadvantage or even wealth extraction for households of color. And then the most recent chapter, 2008, you know, the economic meltdown leading up to that, we know that African-American communities were, again, systemically targeted for these predatory loans, which accounts for the fact that, you know, so black wealth was disproportionately in home ownership and was, you know, millions of people lost their home equity. And white families were more diversified in their wealth. So they owned homes, but they also had savings and investments, and they were able to bounce back. So that's the most recent chapter of why things have played out the way they have.
Now, most of the research that I've seen sort of talks about home ownership as like the single biggest asset that people have and contributing to their wealth. Is that true? And so that's one. The second thing is that when I talk to people and just ask them sort of like what they think closes the gap, they always say like an investment in K-12. Like they're like, if we invest in education, like that'll be the single biggest opportunity driver, and the opportunity leads to wealth creation. Like, what would you say about that? So two things: is housing actually as big of a factor as people think it is? And then, like, what about education?
Housing is important to get sort of on the wealth building ladder, if you will. You know, people save up, purchase a home. That's at least a way to hold value, hopefully build equity. But what you see is once people get the stability of home ownership, then they move on to other forms of savings, other forms of investing. So again, you know, the percentage of, say, black wealth, which is in home ownership or home equity, is much higher than white families, which have much more home equity and leave much greater inheritances to the next generation. So I think home ownership is a really important step. I mean, if we had a policy in this country that just had really good, permanently affordable housing where you only had to pay 20% of your income and you could, you know, it was good quality housing, I think we wouldn't have to be so dependent on home ownership. People could just save money and have decent lives and decent housing. But given that we have this huge, large, mostly private sector housing market, that's and maybe Josh speak to the education question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we can understate the impact of quality education, both pre-K and K through 12. I mean, it can be a transformational experience for millions of families, and it is. Public education, you know, was a radical concept when it was first introduced in the United States centuries ago, and now, you know, can play an equality effect. One of our findings from the report, it simply points out that high school diploma, a white household holding a high school diploma, so where the head of household is white and holds a high school diploma, they have the same level of wealth as black and Latino families who have an advanced degree. So just getting more black families through high-quality K through 12, what the, you know, looking back has shown is that actually not only is that not enough to get to grow wealth in black communities, getting through college does not create parity. And a recent, you know, just made famous by the New York Times study shows that even higher income, once you've like been born into higher income as a black family, you're still struggling to get to the level that white children born into black families are when they're adults. So, you know, the problem is systemic, and Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton have written extensively about this problem where, you know, essentially we think that education is a panacea. And it's not to say that education isn't critically important, incredibly important. It's just to say that having a very high quality and quantity of folks getting, you know, education has not moved the needle previously. It is not to say that it couldn't. It's to say that, like, other forms of oppression have taken hold that strip people of their wealth and halt people from being able to generate the kind of wealth that people not experiencing those types of oppression don't have to experience.
What people also say to me is like, you know, this, it's a suggestion that like black people just save their money more and like invested it differently, that they'd be able to build wealth. Like that is something I've heard more than I thought I'd hear. What's your reaction to that?
You know, I think that we have to just, the sort of individual responsibility story is the counter narrative to that. So here we have, you know, let's just be clear. White households have 86 times more wealth. The median wealth of a white household is 86 times more than a black household, 68 times more than a Latino household. That cannot be explained by a difference in individual effort, you know, postponing gratification, all the stuff that you hear. But people project these sort of simplistic stories of individual effort. I call it the myth of deservedness, which is everybody's where they're supposed to be because that's where they deserve to be. That's like the bumper sticker in our culture. And so, yeah, if somebody has vast wealth, it's because that's where they deserve to be. They get up early in the morning, they're entrepreneurial, they built a better mousetrap, whatever. And the shadow side of that story is if somebody doesn't have wealth or security, then that's where they deserve to be because there's something wrong with them. And so I feel like that, you know, oh, well, if people just save their money is part of that narrative. Yeah, we all need to, you know, think about how to budget better. What is it we really need? Maybe we should cut down on our credit card expenses. I mean, personally, I can say that we all make choices. But is this just a simplistic morality play? That's what's missing is like if you know, if your wages are low, you can't save. If you have parents that you're taking care of or members of your extended family that need your help, it's hard to save. In fact, it's inhumane to save when people have these enormous needs in front of you. So I think that little line just sticks in my craw, I have to say personally.
What is reparations to you and what could it look like in practice?
Well, and to your last point, what you're basically describing when you talk about people saying, you know, black people should really save more and that would solve the racial wealth divide, you're basically describing a personal problem to a systemic or a personal solution to a systemic problem. And, you know, we need a systemic solution to a systemic problem, which is how reparations enter the discussion. I mean, if the problem of the growing economic divide that we, you know, point out every different facet of on inequality.org day in and day out and talk endlessly and research endlessly about, if that could be solved by just a tweak in people's spending and saving habits, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been persisting so greatly. Maybe we wouldn't have the greatest level of wealth inequality since the 1920s that we're facing right now. Unfortunately, this is a problem that's been created over decades, mostly driven by public policy, and will require a different public policy to solve. So, reparations, and a lot of people have written about reparations, like Sandy Darity has a book coming out soon about reparations, and Chuck has an article just out this past year in Quartz on like a serious take on reparations. Well, reparations, what people often think about when they think about reparations is a big check. And for a lot of racist white folks, what they think about is like, you know, young black kids are going to go out and buy new shoes or buy fancy rims on their car. You know, there's just this racist image of what that looks like. I mean, where it's at in Congress right now is a bill that's perennially introduced to just study what reparations can look like. That's how far back Congress is from compared to the rest of the public. Congress isn't even ready to discuss what reparations would look like in practice. They can't even agree to just study the actual example of why we might need it and what it could mean. So to talk about reparations in practical terms is kind of refreshing, you know, I think, compared to where the public discourse has been. And I think folks like Ta-Nehisi Coates and others have driven that discussion forward in a way that we haven't been able to previously.
Yeah, I think that we until we acknowledge the debt, what Randall Robinson called the debt in his book, The Debt, then we are, particularly white America, is sort of in a state of arrested development. We're continuing to kind of live through this false mythology of deservedness. But I think it's helpful to look at, for instance, we did have reparations. Ronald Reagan signed a reparations bill providing reparations to the descendants of Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. And that took the form of both payments, cash payments, but also took the form of, at least originally the intention was sort of cultural institutions. I think the reparations after World War II for Germans of and Jews of German heritage continues to both be in the form of financial support. In fact, I was actually speaking at a workshop on white advantage, and a white woman raised her hand. She says, "I'm a beneficiary of reparations." My grandparents fled the Holocaust, and I continue to get free college education payments as a result of that. So it can take many, many forms. You know, if millions of people were excluded from owning a home, excluded from these public programs like Farmers Home, Veterans Administration, FHA mortgage insurance, let's provide those excluded with the same package that was provided. You know, what kind of house could you buy with a 1% 40-year fixed rate mortgage and with the down payment assistance? You could have wealth building initiatives that were make them available in the same way to those who had been systemically excluded from them. Same with like matching funds for wealth savings accounts, that sort of thing.
Cool. Well, thank you both. I consider you both friends of the pod, and we'll have you back to keep us updated on what's happening.
Thank you, DeRay. This has been great.
Yeah, terrific to talk to you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pod Save the People. Make sure that you rate it wherever you get your podcasts, and I will see you back here next week.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.